Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. On today's podcast, I'm going to interview Loren Druin-Boss, the fifth generation of the legendary Borgogna winemaking family. We're going to talk about all sorts of things about the next generation of Borgogna, including climate change, the future of winemaking, farming. It's an incredible conversation. If you've ever had Borgogna wines, you've probably drank a Druin wine. They're one of the most important and influential families in all of French winemaking. This is a great conversation. Before that happens, the elephant in the room, everybody. The fourth SOM movie, Cup of Salvation, is finally set for release. I apologize. We've been gone for a little bit. We've been prepping the release of this film and also in Europe filming for another film that we're going to announce shortly. For Cup of Salvation, the first places it will show is Los Angeles, Chicago, Napa, Vancouver, as well as New York City and places that we have shown SOM 3 and SOM 2 and SOM 1. This film is incredibly special. I want to tell everybody there's a big reason why it took this long to get together. It was a very dangerous film to make. We filmed all over the Middle East and we filmed during a war we didn't expect to happen. This is a movie that is kind of transcends a documentary. It is the closest thing to Psalm 1 we've made in that you have characters that you will care deeply about in the end of it. It is a really special movie. Go to psalmfilms.com to get tickets. It will be on the big screen first and we'll announce everything else later. And we'll have information for how you can get the wines in this film, because I know many of you who have seen the previous movies have been upset that some of those wines sell out and disappear. So we're going to get ahead of that and try to make it so everybody can get these wines that are in Cup of Salvation before. So stay tuned to the podcast and go to somfilms.com to get tickets. Without further ado, my conversation with Loren about the future of Borgogna wines. Loren, it's an honor to have you on the SOM TV podcast. If there's one thing I love, love, love to talk about, it is Borgogna. It is the region that made me truly fall in love with wine. And now I am broke and have no money because of it. You come from one of the most important, I think one of the most accessible domains in Borgogna, which is Druin. And I have to start this conversation off by asking you, what is it like to be an insider, to belong to a house that is so important and so big? What's it like to grow up in Borgogna?
Well, when you are young, you don't really realize what you part of. So I would say it was growing up close to nature, to the earth. So you really feel the magic of, if I can say, non-human life.
must be nice.
It's very nice. They don't talk. No, they're great. One of my best memory, I would say, was when I was between 5 to 15, going to the winery after school. And, when I was 5, I was just tasting the grape juice. And then when you grow up a little bit, then it's sparkling juice and then wine. And that was very, very nice time. I remember the smell of the winery. And so it brought me back memories when I started working at the Domaine 5 years ago now. And so I would say you don't really realize how big it is, how amazing the history you have on your shoulder and in your family in the past and for the future. It's really understand and living with nature and more specifically vineyards. Mm-hmm. And then when you grow up, I realized that working for champagne houses in Paris, and I realized how amazing our history, our family history, and the history of Bourgogne wines was. So that's how I fell in love again, maybe.
Bourgogne. Did you always want to work in wine? Was there a point where growing up you were thinking, I want to do something different? What were you thinking about doing and how did you get back into wine?
I was more of the opposite. I was maybe around 15, I would say, no way I'm going to work with the family. And then as I said, I worked for champagne houses, but in marketing and for press and then I traveled a bit between my 15 and 25 years old, and I realized what was Burgundy, what was Drouin, how the wine could bring people together, make people dream, happy, you know it. So that's how slowly I realized I could be interested in working for wine companies and more specifically for the family business.
So did the family ask you to come back and say, look, stop messing around at other wineries, come work with us. Was there a conversation or did you come back and say, I think I'm ready?
No, I quit my job in Paris and then I went to Oregon where we have two estates now mm-hmm. for vinification, kind of a gap year, but working. And then I went to Chile for another harvest to learn in another winery, nothing to see with the family. And then when I came back, I said, okay, now I should learn about viticulture and enology because I studied business. So I spent 2 years in school in Beaune. And we have a very good system in France where you can go to school, both to school and work. So you go one week and to school and then you work for a week. So that's how I joined the family business. But they did not ask. They were kind of surprised when I came back, actually. Which is good, which is better this way.
That's right. Yeah, you can negotiate your pay a little better.
Everything.
Yeah, for sure. So talk to me about your family's history and kind of how what I want to understand is how did Domaine Druin become such a big name in Bourgogne? How did this happen?
Well, I think it's all started with Joseph, the founder of the... It's a business because he was a negotiant. He had no vineyard. So he founded the Maison Joseph Drouin in 1880, a few years ago.
A few years, yes.
And he was kind of a, maybe bold is too much, but a brave guy because he settled right after Phylloxera arrived in Europe. And he moved from the Chablis region to Beaune and settled his little business. And then the one who really, really started the domain was his son Maurice in 1918. Same.
Yeah, right after World War.
Yeah, so first plot was he bought was the Clos des Mouches, famous Clos des Mouches, in 1921. Uh-huh. He bought only a few plots and then now it's bigger because he was able to buy a few plots years after years and then we bought also some. So Maurice was the one who started looking after the quality. He thought that if he had his vineyard, he could guarantee the quality of the grapes. So that's how he started at the Domaine. And he bought also the funny story. Well, funny, crazy story about Clos des Mouches is that he had to find a plot he could go to with a horse because 100 years ago they did not have cars. So that's how he lived in Beaune. So he found this, for him, it was the best climate of Beaune. And that's how he chose Clos des Mouches. Yeah. So he's the one who started the domain. He also bought a plot in Claude Vougeot a few years after that. But someone was taking care of the vineyard because he couldn't go take care of the vineyard. It was too far away. Which is kind of crazy when you say that. And it was only 100 years ago.
Right.
And then he passed over to my grandfather, Robert, who bought a lot of vineyards, especially Grand Cru. So that's thanks to him, we have 10 Grand Cru on the Côte d'Or today and 4 in Chablis out
that
of 33.
Incredible.
Yes, great. Yeah. He was really, really smart. We could not do this today, of course. So
yeah, I wanted to ask how in today's climate you would even go about acquiring more land in Bourgogne. It seems like it would be impossible now.
Well, we do. We just bought bought two estates, one in Saint-Romain. It's a bit higher. We really believe in this appellation. We've produced some, but we really wanted to have a vineyard there because especially for climate change, we think it's a good place in a few years would be perfect. And we also bought in Saint-Véran, in the Mâconnais. We really believe also in this area. It's going up and up, but we did not have vineyard there. But it's not in the Grand Cru. Grand Cru, it's really tough now. And yeah, already have very nice ones. So we try to take care as much as we can. And yeah.
So you are making wine in almost all of the major subregions of Bourgogne. It's an astounding thing to think about how juggling all of that. It's truly, I think people have this perception of Bourgogne that is maybe a little right, definitely a little wrong, where they think it's all very expensive. It's very unobtainable. What, from your position, what do you think people get wrong about the, you know, about Borgogna?
Well, you said it. We usually think all the wines from Borgogna are expensive. And it's true, some are really, really expensive, but not all of them. You can find really good Bourgogne wines from 20 euros. We do have some wines you can buy for 20 euros. And we also have 1,000 or maybe more euros. So we produce wine for, I don't know, would say everybody in the world. And it's funny what you were saying about it's really a wide range. From Bourgogne, the regional appellation, to the top Grand Cru. And usually journalists, wine journalists, are coming to us first to, you know, have a average mark. I don't know, I don't know if you're saying this, but to make an idea about the vintage. So they usually
right, so
come
barrel,
to us.
So barrel tasting or tasting early, like...
Yeah, they really usually start for the vintage, with us, so they know a bit about the vintage and the different appellations, the different subregions in Bourgogne. So I think that's also why we are very famous, because we take care of a Bourgogne or a Pommard, as we do take care of a Montrachet or a Musigny. We don't do difference in the way we take care of the grapes, the wine, the bottling and everything.
It really astounds me every time when I get usually someone will give me a wine that's, I taste blind, I don't know what it is, and it'll turn out to be something from the Mâconnais. And it was, like you said, a 22 euro bottle, and it blows my mind. And it is really true that you can get wines from this region that are astoundingly, I don't want to say underpriced, because I don't want them to get more expensive, but there are really good deals out there. Yeah.
Yeah. The very good price quality ratio, and you can find it, and it's easier to find them because we produce more of these wines. So, mm-hmm.
Right,
yeah.
Well, let's talk about the main grapes that you have in the region. So, you are predominantly working with Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Do you have a preference of which one of those grapes you like to work with more, maybe even drink yourself?
Well, if I speak in my name, I would say I love Pinot Noir. I love to taste Pinot Noir. I love the complexity, the story tales. Can blow your mind. I like what is complex in life, human. But yeah. I think Pinot Noir, Chardonnay is amazing. It's an amazing grape, but it's, I would say, easier to grow. It adapts to its environment. We do the experiment in Oregon. Chardonnay are amazing, really. But so they are in Burgundy, and I think they really love the terroir. So they express everywhere, but that's what makes them so unique in Bourgogne. It's the terroir and the limestone. But Pinot Noir is a very demanding grape in its cool nights. Well, we cannot control that, but we're very happy when we have warm days during summer and very cool nights, because it preserves the complexity you can then find in the glass. And I would say it's also a great interpreter, singer, if not the best in the world, to reveal the terroir.
Yeah.
You can drink a Pinot Noir from 10 rows difference, and it's plus the hand of the wine grower and the producer who will make the wine and then make it sing like it wants to. But I think Pinot Noir is very particular for that. It's a very good interpreter, very unique interpreter.
So I want to talk a little bit about the history of the region, and more, not just the lesson in the history, just that there is a lot of history. Do you feel the weight of history while you're making the wine? Is there a feeling in Bourgogne that there is this, you have to live up to the past?
Well, we have 2,000 years of history. So that's a lot. Usually we say the vines were planted by Romans and raised by monks and dukes of Burgundy. And we very humble. We did not invent anything. But that's also a misconception. I would say we are usually looked as dinosaurs. very traditional old guys, you know, not innovating. And which is true in a way, because we do have this heritage of the past and the savoir-faire and the tradition that also makes Bourgogne unique. And with all this knowledge we have about the terroir and how to make these two special grapes express as their best. But we also are always questioning ourselves, especially these last years with the climate change. But it's always been like that. Because of the quality of the grapes, because we are very world-known producers and region, we're always looking for, you know, improved quality, less and less intervention on the grapes to preserve the integrity of the grapes. So I would say it's tough, but it's a balance to find between traditions and heritage of savoir-faire and innovation and modernity.
How do you innovate with so many rules? I mean, you're only allowed to have Chardonnay and Pinot. I mean, obviously you can have, you know, there is another white grape and Gamay occasionally in some places, but how do you innovate and change when there are so many rules? What do you do as the next generation? Because it's an amazing thing to see what the next generation is doing in Bourgogne. And I'm sure you're working so hard that you're not thinking about that, but how do you innovate with everything that's in place?
We are the one who decides the rules. The organization of every appellation is different, a group of different producers. So if we want to make them change, we have to work all together, of course, experiment, and then change the rules. But you, as you said, more and more in the new generation, they're going out of the appellation AOC, the control appellation, and they're going for Vin de France to, you know, experiment and try also to adapt to the climate change. That is a very big subject for us today.
Yeah.
And tomorrow for sure, because we are not a very an annual culture. We plant vineyards for the next generation. But climate change is going so fast that you don't really know what to plant, because in 20 years, you know, it will have changed. Climate will have changed a lot. It's already changing. I have a lot of conversation with Philippe, my uncle, who is in charge of the vineyards. And he said since 30 years, it's crazy how fast it's going.
Let's talk about climate change. So when you say 30 years ago, when was it first noticed as, all right, this is not just a freak weather pattern. This is actually something that is starting to cycle in. It's changing the way things are. Are we talking about it being warmer or just the weather being more unstable?
Both, I would say. But okay. I would say even today, if you ask some people, it's still not very taken very seriously. So that's a bit paradoxal. But when you look at numbers, scientists have made a lot of research for Bourgogne. The big change was 87, 88. It's going... Bourgogne is special in the climate change. It's going by step. So we had 1.1 Celsius degrees more 35 years ago. And I would say it's also correlated to the time we were not the only one, were looking at another way of farming, because we were in this period of nothing against them, but agronomic engineer. So the vineyards were very, that's my grandfather's testimony. I wasn't born, but.
Okay.
and my uncle. The vineyards were looking great. They were very, very, you know, green and a lot of leaves and a lot of grapes, but they noticed that the quality was going down. And when the story said, my uncle loved to go to fishing. And when they were going to the Clos des Mouches to have worms, they were not finding some.
So the worms disappeared in the soil, you're saying?
Well, there were less and less worms, yes.
Okay.
So that's how they, plus the quality going down. So they started to rethink the way they were farming the vineyard, and that's how we started experimenting organic farming. That was end of the 80s. And we went on the whole estate organic in middle 90s, and then quite quickly to the biodynamic practices. So Well, it's easy to say this now. I don't know if 35 years ago they were talking about climate change, but they were saying we were having an impact on biodiversity, the living in the soils. And I would say today there is a very big consciousness of it's impacting all the volume of what we have at the end of harvest because of climate change. It's to answer the question, it's both because of the rise of the temperature, but also more and more very violent episodes like frost or hail, or not fire for now. We had this in Oregon. In 2020, we did not have any crop because of the smoke of the fire. But in Burgundy, touch monkey, but we don't have this yet.
So what's the next generation going to do in Bourgogne to help or to work with the fact that climate change is coming in? From a standpoint of picking and farming, and what's different for the way your generation is farming versus the previous generation?
Well, I'm pushing. I think it's going further than just the farming. I think it's the way we see business. We just committed to something that's called, it's a French group that is called the Convention for the Companies of Climate. And it's a 9-month journey with 50 other companies from Bourgogne. So they do this by region. And it's a... The idea is to write a roadmap to become a regenerative business instead of, so it means you give more to the planet than you take, basically. Mm-hmm. But that's by 2030. And so the idea is to lower our impact or footprint and bring more to the nature. So that means more trees, more grass, more... Birds.
More worms, maybe?
More worms. We do have much more than we had in the 80s. So I would say it's the way we see the business. Maybe optimize the way we export, no more planes, travel a bit more or less, sorry. And I don't know if we are ready to go out of the monoculture, but that could be... I don't know, that's what I'm dreaming in 20 years. Maybe we'll have trees, we'll have wheat in the middle of the vineyard, we'll have other fruit trees.
It seems that might be, I mean, the land there is so expensive. And so yeah. I would imagine it's hard for a winemaker or someone who owns that land to say, let's plant some apples or let's plant, you know, when the grapes are producing so much, I mean, money and also just supporting the economy. I mean, how do you sell someone on taking it out of a monoculture when that effectively is saying we're going to lose money?
Well, it's the big question right now. Yeah. This is also why we joined this association, because we're lucky we work with the non-human life, but when you start digging into what's coming. About the climate change. If we don't change, we might not produce wine in 30, 50 years. And when you are a family business with this history, 150 years of history, 40 years, we're just going through the time of the company. But the idea is to preserve the company and make sure that the next generation, not only the family generation, our family generation, but the world future generation, will be able to produce the wine. And if we don't change the way we make it, we might not be able to produce anymore in, I have no idea, I hope in 50 years, but seeing the way it's coming, it might be in 10, 15. We've already seen a few years, very tough years because of this climate change.
Do you see something extreme like planting different grapes ever in Bourgogne, or would that be like, no way?
Why not? I think the best way to find a solution to we produce Echezo, we produce Clos des Mouches. Mm-hmm. Of course, we produce Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but in Oregon, we also have Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. In New Zealand, you also have Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And I think the very unique thing of Burgundy is this appellation and this we produce, reveal the terroir, which is an Echezo, Clos des Mouches. So maybe we can reveal the Echezo with a Syrah or... I don't know. I don't think it's the solution today. I would say bringing more diversity in the vineyard would be the solution, but you can keep diversity with Pinot Noir.
I always think that the younger generation here, when they sort of rebel, you know, they take their parents' car and drive off and do. I always thought that in Bourgogne, maybe the younger generation, they rebel by planting Syrah or something like they
well,
say.
Well, some of them are trying, but it's a good idea to see, because maybe in 5 years we'll have to take off the Pinot Noir because it's way too warm during at night, and Pinot Noir needs its cool night. So it's good to experiment, but I think it's about experimenting a lot of things. Same as when we started being organic or biodynamic, or in a winery, when you taste you try barrels, different barrels or different tanks or way of producing. So it's all about experimenting and see what's working and share. That's also a very important thing for the future, I think. It's about sharing, because we kind of lose that in our generation and maybe the generation before, because of business, because we're very busy, because the world is going very fast.
Yes.
So that's, I would say, it will work collectively, because we cannot experiment everything, so we have to share experimentation, and it takes time to experiment also.
Yeah, that's really well said. What do you see as the future? You believe that people will stop doing the monoculture? You believe this is the future? Because I'm curious, how do you see, I mean, it's scary to think 30 years from now, I mean, of course, there will be some grapes, but that'll suffer that much. 30 years is really soon.
But if we want to survive, we need to, the base of the business is the planet, and then we have the people, and then you have the economy. So if we lose the planet, then we lose the people, then the economy collapses too. So I would say we have to, of course, continue to make money, but maybe invest it differently. And I don't know if the solution is going out of the monoculture, but we, with different studies in the world, can see that monoculture kind of killed the soils, the lives in the soils. And we need these living soils to reveal the best grapes we can. That's the idea of being of having biodynamic practices. Mm. But we can go with, going only with horses and no more tractors, because we compact the soils. That also kills the lives in the soil. So it's all about experimenting and going out of monoculture. Don't specifically mean out of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and put 100 trees and one plant. Vines, but maybe, I don't know, put some herbs, some thyme in at the end of the rows. These kind of things. And a bit of more trees. Because we need water, and trees kind of call the water. 80 kilometers average. If you have trees, they kind of call the water. So that could be a solution for the future if we lack of water.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I look forward to doing a follow up podcast with you in 30 years to see where we're at. I'll mark my calendar for 30 years from now.
Yes, and I hope we'll drink amazing Pinot Noir and Chardonnay under a tree.
Yes,
in the vineyard.
That's right. That would be. I would love to do that. That sounds wonderful. Well, before we wrap this, I want to know, what do you drink at home in your spare time, when you're with friends, when you're with family? What are you drinking? Are you drinking Eschezo? Are you drinking Corton? What are you drinking?
Well, I would love to say I drink Eschezo and Clos de Mouche, but no, that's for the great occasion, because we don't produce a lot of bottles and we like to share what we produce. So we have a few, but we share them. I love the Saint-Romain.
Saint-Romain is wonderful.
We were talking about affordable and kind of easy to drink wine. That's also a misconception I wanted to talk about. But
sure.
Our generation, I was born in Burgundy, so in Bourgogne, so I kind of seem easy for me. But when you talk to people, 25 to 35, maybe, that want to know more about Bourgogne wines, they're afraid of buying Bourgogne wines, because they think that if they don't know anything about the Bourgogne wines, they're dumb and they don't deserve to drink them. And I would just have to say, you know, you just have to know if you like them or not. That's how it's for most big fans of Bourgogne. That's how it started. Mm-hmm. Do you like the wine or not? And then you might know more and more about it. So I would say Saint-Romain is a very good wine to enter in the Bourgogne world. Yeah. A very, very nice. I usually bring that for aperitif because you can drink it without eating anything.
It's so also Saint-Romain, beautiful, yeah. Beautiful. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah, and now really we'll have an estate, so that's also very good news. And of course, the baby of the family, the favorite one is the Clos des Mouches, and it's always blowing my mind.
Yeah, I wish I could afford it more often.
It's, me too.
Well, Lauren, it's a tremendous honor to have you on the podcast, and I think the next generation seems quite bright in Burgundy. This is good.
Thank you.
Yeah, I look
thank
forward
you for
to
having me. It was a very very nice chat. Always happy to share what we do in Burgundy and how we look for the future.
Yep, very good stuff.
Looks bright and warm.
Yes, looks bright and warm. All right, well, you have a wonderful day, and I'm going to go open up a glass of Chardonnay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank everybody for listening, and I want to remind you that Cup of Salvation, the fourth Somme film, has release dates. If you or anyone you know is in Los Angeles, Napa, New York City, Chicago, you're going to want to go to sommefilms.com and buy tickets. If you're interested in hosting a screening, go to sommefilms.com and contact us because we're going to entertain a limited number of those. All these screenings are going to have Q&As, special events, wine included, and they're going to sell out. So go to sommefilms.com, get tickets for Cup of Salvation. And of course, subscribe to Somme TV. We have a ton of content coming out around the release of this. Bonus features, other documentaries, and special things that are going to come around Cup of Salvation. All right, everybody, please be safe. And I cannot wait to drink with you over this film.